All right. Good morning. Hello, and welcome to today's Heart Investors podcast. My name is Brian Meshkin, and I'm privileged to host this podcast. Today, we are honored to have as our guest, experienced entrepreneur David Ochi, who is the executive director of the Innovation Incubator at Cal State Dominguez Hills in Carson, California. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you. David and I met actually a few years ago, back when he was the executive director of the Entrepreneur Center, which is an entrepreneurship center at the University of California, Irvine, home of the Anteaters, hence the play on the name. At the time, I was involved with the UCI CEO Roundtable, and I learned of the great things that David was doing at UCI and in the community, and just grateful to have stayed in touch with him. He's an experienced entrepreneur with over 30 years of startup experience. Currently, you know, David is in this innovation incubator role at a Cal State here in Southern California. He has previously been himself having direct experience as an entrepreneur through participation and consulting with several hundred companies. So he brings a tremendous amount of wisdom with particular interest in projects that involve overseas components and strategic management needs. Interestingly, David is also a certified Ironman coach, which I just bow down and say, oh my gosh. And if you don't know what an Ironman is, it's not something I could do, but it is where you swim 2.4 miles, you bike over 100 miles, 112 miles, and then run a marathon at 26.2 miles. It's pretty incredible, David. So thanks for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I will say an Ironman is something of a feat, but the great thing, like anything, you start off with one step, right? The beginning of that journey was, of course, before being a coach, was to do it myself. And my very first exercise coming out of, you know, a long period without it, was a sixth of a mile run.
I think I can do that.
And if that's where you have to start, that's where you start. And it was a couple of years later, without any intention of getting into triathlons and the likes, that I was contemplating actually doing a full distance Ironman race, and finally did it. And it was horrible conditions. But you know, it's like anything, you just got to put one step in front of the other and you somehow make it across the finish line.
Well, that's a great metaphor for entrepreneurship, isn't it?
Ain't that the truth? And you'll have bad races along the way. Maybe that's another parallel for that.
For sure. But before we get started, let's pause because I have to give the quick advertising message on behalf of one of our sponsors, Cancer Fund. If you've ever donated to a cancer research foundation in the hopes of helping stop cancer, then you may want to consider learning more about how to invest in Cancer Fund. Cancer Fund is a community of people sharing a passion to change the future of cancer now. They believe that innovation is key, and they're committed to helping promising solutions get from the lab to patients so they can impact lives. They support promising developments in their earliest stages where financial support is difficult and can make the difference between a great idea and a breakthrough in cancer care. Why would someone invest $500 or more in Cancer Fund at the end of the day to help cancer patients and possibly even generate a return on your investment? I've been inspired by the team at Cancer Fund and recently joined them back in March as a venture partner. To learn more about investing into Cancer Fund, or if you're looking for investment into your early stage company that is looking to make a positive impact for cancer patients, please visit www.cancerfund.com. All righty, David, let's go ahead and get started. It's the question that I always start off with in some form or fashion for any guests we have on Heart Investors. I'm interested in what inspires you. So what inspired you to help entrepreneurs from your vantage point in academia?
Well, that's a tough one, actually, in some respects, because like a lot of entrepreneurs, I'm just following opportunities. And so I've been an entrepreneur my whole life. I started my first company when I was 13. It was a tutoring business. I ran that for 11 years, making more money than any teenager should be making. But I didn't know it was all illegal, right? You can't hire other students to do your tutoring for you without going through FICA and minimum wage laws and all this stuff. I think we're beyond the statute of limitations, so I'm okay. But still, I had no idea, right? But it got me into the idea of teaching, and teaching/consulting has been a part of my career. I was doing startups and doing everything from launching my own international distribution businesses in college all the way through, you know, helping Disney Consumer Products launch in Vietnam, right? It just had a wide variety. And I was a coach and a judge for the new venture competition at UC Irvine out of the business school. And the director there, a great guy, Charlie Becker, who unfortunately passed last year, he said, "Hey, I got it. They're doing this new opportunity here called the Blackstone Launchpad. I think you'd be a great candidate for it. You should apply." And I said, "Hey, Charlie, thanks for thinking of me, but that's a job. You know, I don't do that. That's a four-letter word in my book." And he said, "No, seriously, you need to do it. You know, you'd be great at it." And he finally, after a lot of discussion, said, he pulled the friend card and said, "Hey, I got to look good on this committee. Help me out, apply for the job and at least go through an interview. And I could say, yeah, I tried," right? Kind of thing. And
right.
And so I did, I made a resume and, you know, here I am almost 40 and I'm going in for my first interview on that side of the table. And I said, you know, they asked me, you know, typical thing, would tell us about yourself. And then the second question was this opportunity moment that popped out and said, you had the opportunity to start a new entrepreneur program at your alma mater, what would that look like? And I remember being set back by the question. And I said, "But this is supposed to be some cookie cutter thing for Blackstone. What do you mean starting from scratch?" And they said, "Well, of course, but that's only 3 years. We want to know what it would be like if you went through this full thing. Like, what would it be for real if you were, you know, guiding the helm?" Uh-huh. And I gave the worst answer you could possibly give in an interview, which was, "I don't know, but that sounds cool." Because that's basically a startup within the university, right? Cool. And I was given, very thankfully, a very long leash by the initial dean that hired me. She openly said, "I don't know anything about entrepreneurship. I just know that it's cool. Don't make us look bad." That was my, you know, my boundary.
Do no harm.
Feel ethical, exactly. And that really sparked that passion of teaching. And it was really a great intersection of the education side of life, as well as all the entrepreneur fervor I had been doing for 25 years. So it was a great opportunity to go into an academic bureaucracy, which, if you've never dealt with an academic bureaucracy, is pretty much the thickest, most challenging structure to walk into as a, you know, free loving entrepreneurial mind. But it's been a real growth opportunity to do that. So I've loved working with them. I think, you know, obviously the future of our world comes from the youth. They're going to be in our shoes and beyond. And the best thing we can do is help them to make a better world for themselves and their kids. So it's been a blast doing it, Joe, for sure.
That's awesome. What a great experience. I just remember, you know, when you were heading that up and meeting you and hearing about the great things they were doing. I mean, you were literally impacting, like, affecting and touching, I don't know, it was several thousand companies.
Thousand, yeah. Yeah, it was 12, we had, in my 5 years there, I worked with about 1,200 different startup concepts, give or take, you know, somewhere in that ballpark. It was remarkable. And you've got everything from people wanting to cure cancer, right? Cool new technologies and whatever, to, you know, people just wanting to make money to have, I was gonna say beer on weekends. Let's just say books for college. Yeah, we'll go with that. Books for college. You know, because it doesn't matter. Huge scalable startup designed to take over Google, or you know, just a small little thing that's run out of the dorm to pay off some student debt, or, you know, that sort of thing. It really, it's whatever it is, for profit, nonprofit, just get in and do something was the idea. And there's no better time than when you're in college to experiment with that sort of stuff.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I think I was part of my first startup when I was in college. It's a great opportunity, you know, to live and learn. I remember a few years ago, gosh, it was probably 10 years ago now, when I was back in Maryland, I was invited by the local community college there that had a direct matriculation program between its entrepreneurship program. It was called the Center for Business Entrepreneurship, or Center for Entrepreneurship and Business Excellence, or something like that, CEBE. And they had a direct matriculation program with Babson's entrepreneurship program up in Boston, which is a great undergrad program. And so they wanted to come up with a 5-year strategic plan. And because I had done things beforehand, I did that. And then it became me being an adjunct and teaching entrepreneurship and then being a coach. And it was interesting. I mean, you see the myriad of things. I remember helping one young woman. She wanted to start this was 10 years ago. She wanted to start a Belgian waffle truck. And I got to tell you, when she came to me, I didn't tell her this, but I was like, I don't think this is a very good idea. But really passionate about it. Her mom was from Belgium. She had figured out how to get these special little sugars. I didn't think it had a snowball chance in Hades, but I was like, sure, you're passionate about it. You love it. It's part of your story. I'll help you. And son of a gun, she got the business off the ground. And I was so proud of her for doing it. And it's just, you have those, and then you have your technology companies. You know, there's so many iterations of business. And that's just really, really cool that you were able to touch the lives of so many people. Because not just those entrepreneurs, but it's the people they have been employed and their customers who benefited from it. It's just, it's a snowball.
Yep. And one of the most interesting challenges as somebody that's either a coach or a, you know, a director or something of programs like this, or a mentor or anything like that, a volunteer, it's really hard not to interject your own opinion, like you just described. And it takes humility to take a Socratic approach and say, well, let me see where this goes, right? Let's test it. There's no good idea. There's no bad idea. There's only ideas we still have to explore, you know, these kinds of mindsets. And yet at the same time, it's remarkable when we're proven wrong. Right. We're the big guns that understand the world and everything. And, you know, they're 19, no resources, no experience, no networks. And they prove us wrong. And we had one that was making pinback buttons, right? So the little things you throw in a backpack or a lapel or something, right? That had, and at the time, Black Lives Matter was just coming out. And so they made a bunch of Black Lives Matter. And I went, that's great. It's wonderful. You can make that an adorn. Where does this go, though?
Right.
And they were pumping these things out, and they were taking advantage of the movement that was around them. And they sold them, of course, all over campus. And then they started selling them through, you know, online portals and that sort of thing. And next thing you know, they figured out, hey, we're getting tired of, you know, sitting here all night long, just hand making all these things in our dorm room. And they said, but we noticed there's something on Etsy, a pattern that's missing. And they figured out how they could support other Etsy sellers who only sell digital goods to be able to have physical goods. And what it transformed, you know, for them was from being this pin button that, you know, was now going to make mugs or, you know, that kind of product development element to it, to becoming a supplier for other Etsy sellers who have great digital works that they sell. They will take care of all the mugs and the pins and the t-shirts and the, you know, all the commoditized goods for them. They don't have to do anything other than just plug in the, you know, the software that they would build. That's awesome. So they turned into a scalable concept after having been something that clearly wasn't, right? And there's hundreds of stories like that you can find where non-scalable businesses lead to scalable opportunities. And that's one of the reasons I'm really passionate about helping, especially college-age students, to just experiment with ideas. Because once you experiment a little bit with something, you will find the opportunity that's big. It's there. You just got to poke around and learn a bit about it. And if you can make some money along the way, you know, even if it's, you know, relatively speaking, nickels and dimes, it's still giving you experience and wisdom that you're going to carry into the next business that really can go somewhere.
Oh, for sure. And I love that the fact that you focus so much on the youth. I mean, I didn't start a business like you when I was a teenager. I got involved in kind of the social entrepreneurship when following a tragedy. A friend of mine, Chris Kelly, was hit by a car and killed in front of my home. At the time, I wanted to be a lawyer and I was interested in the law, and I wanted to do something to try to prevent such an awful thing from happening again. And so I led a student-led effort where we lobbied for and enacted the very first bicycle helmet law in the United States. And then we did it in surrounding counties. And then I got contacted by the former Surgeon General of the United States, and we created a nonprofit that at the time was called the National Safe Kids Campaign back in 1990 when we started it. And today it's called Safe Kids Worldwide. It's the leading childhood injury prevention advocacy group in the world. But things that I learned when I was 13 and 14 and 15 and 16 about how to align stakeholders and persuade and present and deal with, you know, opponents and, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's amazing how, you know, when you cut your teeth when you're young, these are essential life skills that you can only get experientially. And just like your experience with education and entrepreneurship and kind of defined a life path for you, me thinking someone like me who isn't particularly special could make a positive impact in the world has defined me in this Pollyanna notion that I could do things. And you're helping shape this next generation and have those same experiences, which I think is so exciting. And so tell us a little bit about your current role now. You're heading up this innovation incubator at Cal State Dominguez Hills. Talk to us a little bit about what's going on there.
So yeah, I took this role in the depths of the pandemic, towards the end of 2020. And I wasn't interested in jumping back into an academic role necessarily, but their recruiter and the provost really did an amazing job at reminding me that that's really where my passion is in the teaching side of things, and consulting and starting companies is fun, but there's more to it. And you hit it on the head in your last comment. It's the skills that you learn through these activities. I mean, you didn't start your business saying, I want to create a global nonprofit that will protect youth, right? You said, my buddy had something horrible happen to them right outside my house. I don't want another person to experience that.
Right.
Outside of their home on my street. Like you mentioned, I don't know the details on it, but congratulations to you for doing it. But you got it in your own city or town or whatever, right? Or county. And then it grew, right? Well, one of the challenges I found in entrepreneur programs broadly, and it's something we really believe at the Innovation Incubator, is that we spend too much time focusing on creating these unicorn companies. Everything has to be scalable. It has to be VC fundable. It has to be billion plus dollar opportunities. Well, that's great, except in the world of academics, we're not teaching them to necessarily be billionaires. We're teaching them life skills. We're teaching them things that they can use to be better productive members of society, to have good character, to be good workers, to contribute to the economy, to be good stewards of the planet, these kinds of general things. And yet skills and entrepreneurship kind of get meshed together as well. Go jump into, take a class and then go start a billion-dollar startup, right? And the example I like to use is, imagine we were going to go take flying lessons. Right. The first thing you would do generally, if you've never done anything, is they're going to sit you down in the classroom with a textbook or videos or something, and they're going to walk you through the basics of flying, lift and drag and what the rudder does and how, what to do in emergencies, these kinds of things. And then they're going to take you out when you're ready, and they're going to put you into a tiny little plane, like a little Cessna with two seats in it, with an instructor, and they're going to walk you through everything step by step. And after 40 hours, or plus, you'll be able to go out and get your own license, and then you can learn the more complicated things. And if you keep doing that for years, you too can fly a 787, right? Yeah. But in the entrepreneur education space, we tend to put them in a classroom, say, here's how you start a company. And the first project you work on has to be a scalable venture. It's like jump right into that, F-35. And don't worry if you fail. It's okay. Failure is good. Fail forward. And it's like you're setting them up to fail.
Right.
If you put them into something they don't have the skills to be able to succeed in. And that's why many programs have struggled to get investment into these companies, because they're 19, right? I mean, 22, 25. I mean, they're relatively young, which means by and large, and especially on our campus, they lack resources, right? We're very, very heavy Pell Grant eligible, minority backgrounds, right? Like these kinds of things. We're well over 85% minority. Well, historically, they don't have resources. They're young, so they don't have experience, and they don't have networks because they come from neighborhoods that don't produce productive business networks. So how can we possibly have a fundable venture? And it's why classic university-based programs can't pump out fundable ventures, because they don't have those key resources, experience, and network to become fundable. And yet that's what we train towards. And so one of the things that we're really focused on is skill development, mindset development, finding the non-VC path. Go start the little local nonprofit element first, and then worry about being a billion-dollar nonprofit that's going to change the world on a much larger scale. Find that local individual micro business or whatever it is where you're going to learn the skills you need to have in order to be a successful entrepreneur. Let's face it, everything before funding, and you know this as well as anyone, Brian, before you get tons of money in some sort of large round, the entirety of your success is all based on your own skills and network.
That's it.
If you can perform and get your network to perform for you and do magic things, then you will get over the, all right, they can do something hump.
Right.
You'll get some money, right? But unless you are born or have some access to an amazing family network that just likes to drip money into your pocket or fire hose it in, whichever the case may be, you've got to prove yourself with skills. So, but we don't teach those skills generally, right? We don't teach someone how to launch a product. Where's the course on product launch,
right?
and it not being scalable. Well, here's what you've got when you have a $2 million launch budget, exactly. Right? Here's what you do. It's like, well, that's not what I have. Let me check here. I have a $278 and that's got to also buy me food for the next 5 days.
Right.
Right. How do you do it from there? And the way is you scope down the work. If you're trying to launch a Google competitor, maybe you do need 2 million to launch, probably a lot more than that. Right. But you can launch a small little micro business selling, you know, the paintings that you did over the weekend, or, you know, or doing some computer coding or ballet lessons or, you know, whatever it is, in a very functional way for relatively cheap. But you're going to learn all the skills you need along the way of what it's like to really run a business and understand the market without having to have a whole bunch of formal training. And that's really what the Innovation Incubator is designed around, is helping empower the youth of our cities, right? And our markets are Watts and Compton, and, you know, we're South LA and South Beach area, right? Or South Bay area. And that mindset, it doesn't come from Silver Spoon generally, right? It's really redefining an urban university. And what we're trying to do is redefine an urban entrepreneur program that can really help these people gain the mindset and skill sets to be able to transform their lives and the communities around them.
Oh, that's so exciting. I just think that's so important, so special, because whether their business succeeds or not, they won just by virtue of learning those skills.
Bingo.
Yeah, no, that's critically important. What a great curriculum. Yeah, oftentimes when I speak on entrepreneurship or those type of things, I'll have little euphemisms that I'll talk about. And so many entrepreneurs that I know, I think I was this way when I first started my first business, they operate on a hypothesis, on an if-then statement. Well, if I can raise this money, then I can do that. Mm-hmm. If I can do this, then I can do that. And I always tell them, it means that your success is conditional, because an if is a very conditional statement.
Pretty much.
And to really be successful, you need to eliminate the if. You need to say, okay, then is what I want. So what am I going to do? Like you said, it's doing lessons. It's a side hustle, whatever it is, whatever it's going to do to get you. And at the end of the day, you may be selling something else of somebody else's to the client that you want to have a relationship with, to get the money and the relationship to then be able to create what you want to give them to that existing customer relationship. There's always a way to do it. And the line from point A to point B, at least in my life, maybe I'm a bad planner, is never straight. It's always a zigzag.
Exactly. And a few circles and a few cliffs in the middle.
Exactly, for sure. No, I think it's great. You know, oftentimes we'll say they're makers and takers in this world, you know, and the entrepreneurs are the makers, the inventors are the makers, those are the ones that are making it. You know, there are plenty of takers. You know, the government's a big taker, you know, they take taxes, they take regulations, they do whatever kind of thing. And there are other people that take, but, you know, we need makers, and we need people that can make things. They're the ones that create jobs. They're the ones that create products. And I think that's what you're doing. You're creating the makers of the future, the people that are going to build that future.
Well, and that's part of it's a big mindset, right? Where they've been trained to think that their conditions around them, their socioeconomic status, their background, their life history, their family's life history, the community they come from, whatever it is, somehow dictate. That's the if you will, of if you're in this position, then such and such. And that's just not the case. Right. It's if you want to be successful, you have to be willing to go out on a limb and go over some of those cliffs on the line from A to B. And you've got to be the one that takes charge of your career. Part of it is just really fixing the mindset from believing that you're a victim of your own circumstances to being the master of your own destiny. And that shift in mindset says that I can do it because I want to, and I may not succeed the first time, but if I keep working at something, hard work will pay off. And it may not be the goal that I initially envisioned, because the world will spin you around, but you'll find that you end up in a worthwhile spot. And even if you don't hit that initial goal, where you land is better than where you were before, and it will probably be worth it. And that's all. I mean, you and I could go on for hours about the failures and little, even micro failures along the way of our journeys. And we learn from those. Those are the places we really learn. Right. And my big attitude is find reasonable goals for the students where they're at. Yeah. I can't expect somebody who is, you know, a parent of two kids and, you know, as supporting both their parents and their grandparents in the household, right? And is coming from a disadvantaged background, no savings to speak of, you know, renting just in a financial hole while trying to also earn their bachelor's degree is going to go start a competitor to Dropbox and be successful.
Right.
But you know what I can do is help them have a little side hustle that they could squeeze in, maybe even work with some of the other family members in the house and squeeze an extra 500 grand, 2 grand, whatever the number is, into the household. And that can be life-changing for families.
Yep.
And yet everything we try to teach in entrepreneurship in most programs is so focused on the big, grand, scalable amazingness. They miss out on the micro venture, that side hustle, that opportunity to change the world. I mean, imagine if someone could just make a few extra $100 a month and yet it allows them to finish their degree.
Yeah.
Well, maybe that's the product. That's the benefit of it, is they got their degree and got a better job as an accountant or as a lawyer, or, you know, whatever they end up doing.
Yeah.
Or their kid is able to get the proper time at home with a tutor. Or the mom is able to spend time with the kid tutoring them, right? Like, just it's those micro wins that we don't track, that a VC certainly would not care about, you know, in determining its investment. But those are the social impact wins, right? It's the changing of the lives. And so a lot of it's empowering that individual to understand that they do have the capabilities to use innovation and entrepreneurship as a tool to better their own lives as well as the lives of their communities. And when they envision that as being a tool rather than like a you know, I'm now an entrepreneur and it's like an end. It's like, I did it. I'm an entrepreneur. It's no, this is a tool. That's like saying, I'm a driver. And it's like, okay, you can drive. I mean, when you're 16, that's the world, I realize. But then you realize it's not the act of driving that what makes the difference. It's the fact you now have freedom to go someplace because you're able to drive, that it's now, okay, where do you want to go? You see it as entrepreneurship as a tool, and it's a license, if you want to use a driving example, right? It's a license for you to determine your own destiny. And again, it doesn't have to be take over Google. That's fine,
right?
If you just want to change your life and have it so that you help your parents own the house that they're in, or you get a down payment for your own house, or your kid gets better education or gets the medication they need, that's all good. There's no bad in there. Right. So determine what it is you want in life. And as far as I'm concerned, as long as it's legal and ethical, I'm backing you 1,000%.
That's awesome. What a great message. Well, David, you're the first person affiliated with a university incubator that we've had on our show. So I'm dying to ask, you know, with the resources, if a entrepreneur wants to, you know, partner up with an incubator at a university, how can universities be a partner or be helpful for that entrepreneur, for entrepreneurship, for driving, even social impact investing, for those that are saying, yeah, I want to invest in an entrepreneur in a distressed community, or I want to give back in my community. And so I'm going to work with the incubator at my university or whatever. How do you see universities as a partner and being helpful in that?
So universities are at a very interesting time when it comes to entrepreneurship. You know, 25, 30 years ago, back when I was in, you know, college kind of timeframes, we didn't have this stuff. I was an entrepreneur out starting all sorts of things. I didn't even know how to spell entrepreneur, let alone have a program that was teaching me how to spell it, right? Like there's tons of programs, right? Dominguez Hills, we have multiple programs that exist, and many universities. It's gone from having a handful of universities like Babson, right? Really pioneering a lot of the entrepreneur space, to now many campuses like a Berkeley have several dozen different entrepreneurial programs, right? The interesting question is, what are they focused on, right? Mainly scalable ventures and some in majors and minors and classes and kind of an academic not applied version of the sport. So many, frankly, have these programs and do amazing work. And this is not to belittle the work they're doing. But when it comes to how can we best interface the community and help the community, especially when it comes to social entrepreneurship, wow, that is way beyond the edge of their bleeding edge envelope, right? Uh-huh. Like they're lost. So actually the best thing you can do is come up with what you can do with them, for them, and propose it. So for example, I'll give you an example. When I took over the center at the end of last year, I was contacted by a buddy I had met a few years ago from Onk Impact Ventures, right? It's a guy out of Toronto named Pierre. And he said, hey, I see you're in this new role. We're an impact investment group. What can we do? Right. Now, if I was your average person, we'd say, okay, so you want to invest, but if you can walk into them and say, hey, here's what we'd like to do. We'd like to set up a competition. Like in our case, we have a pitch competition in October that we're going to do where we're going to find 10 finalists as presenters, and Pierre and his fund are going to put in 25 grand in investment into the top three teams. Okay. Right. And so we're creating a pitch competition around the social impact message. Right. And a lot of programs don't know what to do with it because they, you know, they say, okay, I've got an entrepreneur here who wants to do something social and we got to figure out what to do. Best thing we can do is let's find ways to help the entrepreneur programs, frankly, catch up. Right. And figure out what they can do. And the campuses have great access to talent, both young and mentor network kind of related in alums and community and everything. Figure out what you want from the entrepreneur or from the entrepreneur program at the university and say, hey, we got an idea to do X. And as long as there's value to the university in the form of engagement with alums, donations coming in, new curriculums that they can develop, you know, whatever it might be, they'll work with you on figuring out how to make that happen. But it really helps to let them know, you know, how you think it's going to benefit the university or the students. And because frankly, they're just trying to keep up, especially with COVID and everything that's happened. They're trying to figure out, you know, which way doors open and what kind of ventilation, you know, vents they have and stuff. I mean, they're way distracted. Just, hey, propose something. Hey, let's do this. What do you think? We'll help you out. You help us. We help you. And just look at it as a collaboration and look at it as a long-term thing. Social impact and values-based entrepreneurship is huge. And it's not just an emerging trend. It's a trend that's here. Right. And is there to stay. And one of the best competitions out there is Values and Ventures by Texas Christian University. They have pioneered a social impact kind of approach for the undergrads in particular. So great. So we're looking to model things like that at Dominguez Hills. Well, find ways with your local university that you can model programs. The great thing about entrepreneurship, and you know this as well as anyone, Brian, you test things, you try them, right. You see what happens. And if it doesn't work, you high five each other and say, well, that sucked. And you learn from it. You either do it again better or you say, forget it. This isn't the right thing to do. And you give up, right? It's okay. You work it out and you accept those failures and you move on, but just find a way to collaborate and just make sure there's value to the university or the students. And if they say no, you know, you can always do it without the university and let them come running after you later. And say that's I want to do this. Wait! Don't leave us out of it.
No, that's really really good advice. I think for entrepreneurs that are looking ways to collaborate with the university, because there's a lot of credibility when you can have a collaboration with the university and put that kind of name, you know, based on your community and that brand associated with what you're doing, for sure. Whether it's transferring technology, having a collaboration from an innovation standpoint, whatever it may be. And I also appreciate, you know, when you talked about social impact and social entrepreneurship being a trend, I remember when I was serving on an advisory committee a little over 10 years ago, and I suggested this idea of social entrepreneurship, which was, you know, I've been doing this since I was 13, but it's 10 years ago, it was still kind of fairly new. And I started actually teaching it in the class that I did. And I remember looking over like a 4-year period when we started talking about it, and we would have these business plan competitions every December. And after the first year, there was one or two. And by year four, 90% of all of the businesses these students were starting had a social entrepreneurship, social impact component to it. And so I really think that it's something that resonates with this next generation.
Very much so.
Important because, I mean, the reality is, we look at all the money that government has spent over the past 30, 40 years. There isn't a problem they've solved yet. But businesses solve problems every single day, and nonprofits address the gaps in our society every single day. And so right. At the end of the day, you are creating problem solvers that are going to help our society. I think that's so special.
One quick thing, there's a pivot that eventually takes place mentally about social entrepreneurship or social impact companies, right? And that is going from it being a category, like, oh, we have consumer products and we have consumer services and B2B businesses and healthcare. And then there's these other people over here, right? These social entrepreneurs. Oh, they're doing like, I don't know, they're doing like nice things. Like literally that kind of awkward, we can't define it, but it's over there and just give them a prize kind of feel, to it being mainstream expectation based, right? Where basically my philosophy is every company that's going to work with our incubator is expected to be looking at the triple bottom line. Now, it doesn't mean that every single one of them has to have a pure mission on all three bottom lines, but they should have a mission beyond just one,
right?
Being profit, right? But every nonprofit even has to think about profit because they have to stay afloat, right? So you have to think multimodally about it. And so the expectation, we're not going to put up on the wall that says, now helping social entrepreneurs, join us now, right? It's no, if you're coming in, we're going to challenge you as to what is your social impact? How are you dealing with the people, the planet, and the profit that you're going to face?
Right.
We expect there to be at least two and ideally three. If you can't do all three, well, then we're going to ask you, what can you do? How could you look at shifting? Because the mode of expectation, and especially in American society, is that you are thinking beyond just the profit bottom line, that you are looking at how you're helping communities or helping the planet along the way and being respectful, at least, of those elements. So in other words, we've shifted it from being a focal point and a defining part of our mission to an expectation. That of course we expect you to have these type of approaches, rather than it being something, well, you're unique because you're taking that triple bottom line approach.
No, that's such great feedback. And David, I know we share a passion for entrepreneurship. And as we've discussed, the mission of this podcast is really to help and educate and inspire others to be heart investors, in the sense of not just being smart investors and investing in things they're familiar with, but to invest in things that they really care about. Because those heart investors are going to support social entrepreneurs. They're going to support causes that are important, whether it's a disease that's impacted their family or something that's impacted their local community. Instead of looking to the government, even though, you know, I started my mission on all this and passing a law, I came to realize that the law in and of itself didn't solve the problems. When I did research at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health afterwards and looked at it, it was when stakeholders were in a community aligned around it, where industry, public health, public education, advocacy groups were all aligned, then the law worked, because laws don't solve problems, which is why the government can't solve anything. And so we need people to be heart investors. We need to mobilize people with good intentions to stand up to special interests, whether they're in business or in government or other places that want to preserve the status quo and invest in new technologies and solutions. And I know you do these type of things. You invest and you help these companies as a heart investor, as an entrepreneur. And so I'm wondering what your advice would be as to how you think we can inspire more people to be heart investors.
But one is for people to understand that it's not scary, yeah. Right? There's a natural, and you know this from the evolution, there's a natural belief that a social entrepreneur investor, an impact investor, is going to have a lower profit motive and therefore a lower profit, period. Like they're somehow taking on more risk and getting less return. And from an investor standpoint, that just sounds completely antithetical to the point of investing, right? Sure. Like, wait a minute. And yet, you know, you can measure the triple bottom lines and that's wonderful. But I think one of the things it's somehow like a badge you have to earn in order to be able to do it. And the reality is everyone does it. They just don't know they're doing it. And then what I mean by that is, you know, somebody who might be investing, you know, managing even investments of, you know, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars into social, you know, enterprises, that's all wonderful. And of course, they're definitely doing that. But somebody who doesn't have any money to spare, but shows up to their Kiwanis Club and helps dish out food at an event as a volunteer, that is social investing.
Right.
It's not treasure that they're investing, but they're investing their time. There's not a lot of talent per se in that. But, you know, in the fundraising world, there's a big phrase of time, talent, and treasure. Right. And university, you know, live on that is, hey, get people involved with their time, then use their talent for mentoring and maybe teaching or, you know, whatever it is. And eventually then the treasure will show up. In this respect, I think everyone can be a heart investor. Everyone can invest time into something. Even if you're just helping the local nonprofit do something seemingly mundane, to them, it's life-changing. I mean, I can't tell you the number of times, you know, you go and you just help somebody move some boxes out of a warehouse. You know, you just get a few people over and you do it, and it only takes 30 minutes to do it. But for the person that is no longer having to do that, they were going to have to spend all of Friday night moving all those boxes by themselves one at a time. You just freed up time for them to go spend time with their kid or to work with somebody that in their nonprofit or whatever it is, right? So invest your time, invest your talent, be a mentor, be a coach. Help people with what they're doing. And if you can, if you have any amount of treasure, don't squander the idea of giving $5 isn't worth anything. No, it's worth a ton. Give people that little bit of support, and just the gesture can change the outlook for somebody that's receiving that, right? And so it doesn't have to be huge treasure amounts that you invest. Anyone can be a heart investor, right? By donating their time, their talent, or if they have it, their treasure, and move forward in their communities. And my only recommendation would be start local. The more you can do locally, the greater the impact will be initially. And great local organizations can't stay local.
Right.
They inevitably spill over into other communities and become models for other organizations. And so don't be afraid. Don't think that social impact investing or something like that is like a category of people that accept lower returns because they have a feel-good mission in mind. No, it's everyone trying to do anything they can to push a direction, you know, a movement forward.
No, that's great advice. Well, David, thank you for taking the time today to answer my questions and share your expertise and insights with our listeners. It's our hope that for those listening, by hearing David's thoughts, you too have been inspired to create some positive change in our world and maybe even do something entrepreneurially to make the world a better place. Our world certainly needs more heart investors. We also want to thank our sponsors at Cancer Fund. We look forward to interviewing heart investors from across the globe every week. To learn more, visit us at www.heartinvestors.org. We're listed on Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts. We already have our first dozen or so guests lined up. So until next time, as we always say, instead of being manipulated by those in the media, industry, or government and having us focus on the differences between people, let's focus on how people can make a difference. Make it a great day, everybody. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.